Episode 48. As God is my witness on you, it looks good. Well, welcome to my Brooklyn accent. I lived there for a while, so I feel like I can have a Brooklyn accent without, you know, necessarily insulting anyone from Flatbush. It's done with love. And actually, you're wondering why in the world that's the title to this week's show. And the reason is because, thanks to Katie at Chop Yarn Love, we have a t-shirt that you can buy. And Katie has put it up, I think, basically at cost. So it's not like anybody's getting rich off this. If you want a t-shirt, get a t-shirt. Well, I suppose Cafe Press is probably making some money off of this. But we have these wonderful t-shirts. And Katie put up a whole bunch of different styles. If you don't see a style that you would like, email me at mamaoknits@gmail.com, and Katie and I will work it out to make sure that you can get what you want, because, you know, it's about you. Katie did a really wonderful job on the design. She found a much more colorful picture of Madame Defarge, although she looks a little benign in the picture, but maybe that's better. You don't want to really truly frighten everyone you see on the street with the bloodthirsty knitter on your chest and back. So I'm very excited about that. Katie also came up with a suggestion, which I deeply agree with, that if you get a shirt, take a picture of yourself in it somewhere, and maybe even somewhere that kind of, you know, represents what part of the world you live in, because we've got listeners in Scotland and Sweden and Australia and all over the United States, and a couple from Canada, and another one from an interesting place. I need to thank Carrie for some very interesting information. Carrie wrote and said, here's some more random information for you, and I have this on the show notes as well, so if I go through this quickly, you can go read it later. The Bedlam Mental Hospital in London still exists. It is now a building called the Salisbury House off of London Wall and Finsbury Circus in central London, and it houses several law firms, offices, among other things, including the London office of the company I work for. You might say there's not much change there then. Although the office parts have been altered and updated, the stairwells are still, as I imagine, they always have been, complete with tiled walls. It's a very strange mixture of a building to walk around in. And yeah, the tiled walls, I think even in Murat Saad, the movie / play that I talked about, I think in that the walls are tiled because, you know, they'd have to hose them down. Really just deeply unpleasant. If you saw Batman Begins, the Arkham Asylum, there are images from Arkham Asylum that match images I'd seen from Bedlam, which is kind of disturbing because you want to look at Arkham Asylum in the Dark Knight comic books and in that particular movie and think, wow, thank God nothing ever existed that looked like that. And of course, that's just sadly not true. Did exist, and I hope doesn't exist anywhere anymore, because it was pretty much an ungodly horror. But Carrie, thank you very much for sending that on, because I actually did. I think I did think that the place had been torn down. I know a lot of places that had kind of bad vibes were torn down, and I'm kind of interested. Write to me again, because Bedlam was kind of a disturbing place to be for quite a long period of time. And I've been to a few places, the 9/11 pit, probably the most well-known, but a couple other places where, you know, bad stuff happened, or at least creepy stuff happened. And I've had this discussion with a few people who've been to places like Auschwitz, or people who've been conversely to particularly holy sites, people who've been to like Delphi, where the Oracle at Delphi it used to be way back in the day. And we've talked before about how places seem to hold sensory information. Like you can walk into a place and get a good vibe or get a creeped out vibe, but any place that something kind of monumental has happened, there's a vibe. And I'm wondering if the old Bedlam Hospital carries that. I know. Oh, one of the places was the Tower of London. I remember walking in there and just going woof, and you know, not Tower the yard, although there were parts of it that were kind of creeped out, but the actual tower where the prisoners were held, and Anne Frank's house in Amsterdam, not her house, but the house behind the house, the apartment where they hid for years. That place was just sorrowful. That was hard. There's a picture of me with my sister, and I am not generally, as you may be able to tell, a particularly down person, but I look like somebody just backhanded me. It's, you know, I was, what, 20? Is that right? No, it was 87. Yeah, I was 20. And I do. I just look like somebody hit me. So, on that happy note, I have also included a link to a ridiculous site. It's a YouTube site. I keep finding these YouTube sites. It's called Battle of the Bands. The imagery is not for young children, and if you're the parent of even a teenager, you probably would want to preview it before letting them see it. But it certainly dates me. So if you are the kind of person who was 20-ish in 1987, just to mask my actual age, there's a video called Battle of the Bands where they take a bunch of record album covers that you would be familiar with, as was I, and they fight each other, and it's completely ridiculous, and part of it gets really quite gross towards the end, but it sure does bring back memories of some, well, some really lousy music and some actually pretty good music. So I put a link to that. So I've engaged myself into the Harry Potter sock swap, and part of what you were supposed to do is go through one of the various sorting hat sites, and it turns out I'm in Ravenclaw. I'm not in Gryffindor. I don't remember who's in Ravenclaw, but at least it's not Draco Malfoy. That's all I'm saying. I'm just glad, and I'm glad I'm not in Hufflepuff. I don't know what it is, but the name... I'm not that nice a person, I think. I couldn't be in a place called Hufflepuff without grimacing and probably making fun of the founder of the house, and that just wouldn't be seemly. And speaking of seemly, today we have some interesting seemly happening in old Charles Dickens. I need to remind you, we are in the middle of the trial of Charles Darnay. Last week we listened to a couple chapters dealing with the setup, so you kind of know what the crowd is feeling like as we head into Darnay's trial. Well, and today, chapter 4 of book 2 is called A Golden Thread. Chapter 4 is called A Disappointment. Now, when you get to the end of the chapter, you will understand that title is dripping with irony, and it relates completely to the mood of the crowd. You know, last week they were all excited and bloodthirsty and, you know, hoping that the traitor would be hung and drawn in court. You know, they've talked about all this kind of gross stuff, and Dickens certainly doesn't take kindly to any of that, but this chapter is called A Disappointment. It's also book 2, The Golden Thread. You will find out what the golden thread is, and it gets explained to you. It's obviously, because Dickens doesn't do anything on accident, it's relating to the golden hair that was in Dr. Manette's little rag that he kept around his neck when he was in the prison. But there's also another explanation that Dickens uses. And I'll tell you, honestly, I listened to to make sure that the next few readers were okay. I listened to like 6 chapters today, and I honestly can't remember if the golden thread is explained in this chapter or the next. Either way, it does get explained, and it'll get explained soon. But today's chapter is like 34 minutes long, so you're only going to get one of them today. But today is one of the, in many ways, it's one of the more fun chapters. I think I've talked about this before, that Dickens really tried on purpose to write a very different book from the books that he'd written in his other books, you know, his other tomes. Usually he relies on character and characterization and particularly dialogue to not only move the plot, but to provide you with the humor and the anecdotes and the really rich characterization. You know, he names people very specifically, and he writes extremely good descriptions of how, you know, usually grotesque these people look. And we just haven't seen that at all. You know, he really hasn't made fun of anyone in this book yet. We've had some amusing stuff with Jerry Cruncher, and certainly the relationship between Jerry Cruncher and his wife is funny, but it's not like he's making fun of Jerry or his wife. He's letting Jerry make fun of Jerry's wife, but I think our sympathy comes out with her. So it's all a little bit different. And there are some people who really feel that Dickens blew it in this book by walking away from what he did best. I personally think my husband's a playwright, and although he has, you know, a day job now that we have a family, but my husband is a playwright. And one of the things that we always get irked by when we're reading like movie reviews and theater reviews and things like that is, it shouldn't be a reviewer's job to say, I'm the reviewer and I liked it because I like this kind of humor, drama, horror, whatever it is. It should be the reviewer's, I mean, this is our humble opinion, but it should be the reviewer's job to look at what the writer, director, the team wanted to do and then say, okay, did they manage to do it or not? Dickens set out to write a very specific kind of book, a plot-driven book that was not completely consumed by clever characterization and parody, and instead conveyed some actual huevos, you know, some pathos. And if you're looking at this book with that lens, I don't know how you could be disappointed with what Dickens hath wrought. I think he does a superior job of pulling together sentiment and drama, and I'm on a soapbox and I'll stop in a second, but I think it's good. And I've been getting some really nice emails from people who had Fear of Dickens. God, that's another t-shirt, isn't it? F-O-D. Fear of Dickens like I did. And it makes me feel really good because I'm certainly indebted to Julie for making me, goading me into listening to this book. And I'm glad I can share that goading with some of you, because I think we all wind up the better for it. So today's chapter opens with wonderful parody. You know, finally we're in a place where Dickens has to rely on dialogue, and it's the courtroom. He parodies the Attorney General so beautifully. You must listen carefully, and you will come across points as you have before where I think you probably will want to rewind and listen again just to make sure you caught what you think you caught. Because this man is so unbelievably pompous and obnoxious and full of himself, and is trying to paint his witnesses as such amazingly perfect people that he kind of hyperboles himself into these corners, and he's just pathetic. It's just sad. He's so over the top. So you have this wonderful Attorney General thing with all this kind of self-important legalese. And of course, this is a treason trial. So the outcome for this is huge. Darnay is going to die if he's convicted, and he's going to die badly. Nobody will be happy about this. So it's really great to see some of these witnesses that the Attorney General brings forward, and to see how he makes them out to be, you know, on the left hand of Jesus kind of things. And then Stryver, finally, well, Jerry Cruncher, but we get a name that is very Dickensian. We have the lawyer for Darnay whose name is Stryver. Okay. Stryver cross-examines and just rips these people to shreds. And it's so much fun to watch. Stryver is also an interesting character. He is far from perfect. Even though he's Darnay's lawyer, he is not his own pillar of virtue. We really only have two pillars of virtue in this book. We have Darnay and Lucy. And I've talked before about the fact that they are kind of blah. They are, you know, melodramatic placeholders. There are certain character types that show up in drama and literature over and over, and those characters are fairly stock. And, you know, all you have to do is go watch A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and the girl is named Hero. This is just the way old theater and, in some sense, old literature was done. You have certain characters, and it goes back to, like, well, it goes back before Commedia dell'arte, but in Commedia dell'arte, you have Colombina, you have the young ingenue, you have Harlecchino, the prankster, you have the Doctore, you have the Doctor. Punch and Judy characters, you get the same exact characters. So we don't really have a coquette in this story. We don't have Colombina, who's out there kind of playing tricks, but we do have the beautiful ingenue who wins the guy in the end, and that would be Lucy. And of course, I don't think I'm giving anything away in saying that Darnay is the guy, because for one thing, I've already said it, and for another thing, nobody who's the main character is going to get killed off in chapter 4 of book 2 in Dickens. Maybe chapter 4 of book 5, when there's only 5 chapters in book 5, but not here in book 2. So, I hope I'm not spoiling, I hope you're not shocked that Darnay's not going to die at the end of this chapter. But in some ways, in kind of a Brechtian sense, I don't know if you probably haven't. God, seeing a Brecht play done correctly is almost impossible to do in the States. But one of the things Bertolt Brecht tried to do was he called it theater of alienation. Not that he was trying to alienate you, like making you hate the play, but alienate you from your emotions so that you could watch the play. You can tell he's German. Watch the play dispassionately so that you as a viewer can learn something from the god-awful mistakes that the characters in the play make. So he would, as a way to remove you from any kind of emotional surprise, he would have a character usually walk across the stage with a title for each scene and or act. And the title card would always be something like, in which Prince Ashvili loses his life. So you know before the scene ever starts that he's going to die. The thing that's interesting about Brecht, and it's true of Dickens as well, is just because you know Prince Ashvili is going to die doesn't mean you won't cry. Because when you have a good writer, it really doesn't matter if you know the ending. I knew the ending of this book. I knew it since ninth grade, and I didn't care in ninth grade. But with all of the buildup and all of the work that Dickens puts into the book and all of the brilliant writing, it really doesn't matter if you know the ending or not. All it means is that you're going to look at how he constructs that ending better. I hope that made some sense. Boy, I wasn't expecting to talk about Brecht. I have notes, but sometimes they just, you know, you can hear them just kind of flying out the window, and then and then I just go. The point that I'd written down that I wanted to make about Darnay and Lucy is that Sidney Carton is finally introduced in this chapter. And like Madame Defarge, he is going to look like he's not paying attention. And you will find by the end of the chapter that he is anything but lackadaisical in his attention to Darnay, to Lucy, and to the importance of this case. And even though his reasons for popping up and being helpful may appear to be cynical at best, you know, just an opportunity to win, and therefore he takes that opportunity because he likes winning, I think you will see that the duality that goes on in this book goes far beyond dark and light, the golden and the dark, the Sidney Carton and Charles Darnay looking as though they were twins, that Carton's duality is not just the Darnay duality, it is an internal duality. And you'll see that unfold over the next few chapters. It takes a while to get all the pieces of Carton out, but it's well worth it. And I also wanted to mention that Carton, it's not really fair to ding Darnay and Lucy for being kind of boring, because Dickens is writing in the wake of people like Lord Byron, who invented what's called a Byronic hero, not an ironic hero, but a Byronic, Byron, Lord Byron hero, who is, he's Han Solo. You know, he's the guy in black who's kind of a bad guy. He's James Dean. You know, he's kind of edgy. He's kind of bad. He's so hot. You just can't help but love him because he's so hot. And he's a little dangerous. And Carton has to be that guy. And ultimately, really, you almost have to care about Carton more for the ending to work. He has to be more interesting. He has to be more complete in his character to make the end work. So I'm not going to go on and on about how boring Darnay and Lucy are. It's been said, and, you know, they're only sort of really boring. But there's important things happening with Sydney, and you're going to get the first taste of that tonight. And there's going to be another reference to a recalled to life. Another character is as though recalled to life tonight. And that's kind of nice because we loop around with that for a while in this book as well. Again, Dickens is not doing anything on accident, and he's certainly not setting up anything on accident. Everything is very carefully plotted, which is why the criticism of it is not being as good as his other books really kind of bugs me, because he's just as careful in Great Expectations as he is in this. And I see by the clock on GarageBand that I am completely out of time. Since I want to get you to your chapter, I am going to leave you with Hallelujah, Chip, reading a long chapter. Chapter 3, A Disappointment, part of Book 2, The Golden Thread, part of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities.
Mr. Attorney General had to inform the jury that the prisoner before them, though young in years, was old in the treasonable practices which claimed the forfeit of his life. That this correspondence with the public enemy was not a correspondence of today, or of yesterday, or even of last year, or of the year before, that it was certain the prisoner had for longer than that been in the habit of passing and repassing between France and England on secret business of which he could give no honest account. That, if it was the nature of traitorous ways to thrive, which happily it never was, the real wickedness and guilt of his business might have remained uncovered. That Providence, however, had put it into the heart of a person who was beyond fear and beyond reproach to ferret out the nature of this prisoner's schemes, and, struck with horror, to disclose them to His Majesty's Chief Secretary of State and Most Honourable Privy Council, that this patriot would be produced before them, that his position and attitude were, on the whole, sublime, that he had been the prisoner's friend, but at once, in an auspicious and an evil hour, detecting his infamy, had resolved to immolate the traitor he could no longer cherish in his bosom on the sacred altar of his country. That if statutes were decreed in Britain, as in ancient Greece and Rome, to public benefactors, this shining citizen would assuredly have had one. That, as they were not so decreed, he probably would not have one. That virtue, as had been observed by the poets in many passages which he well knew the jury would have, word for word, at the tips of their tongues, whereat the jury's countenances displayed a guilty consciousness that they knew nothing about the passages, was in a manner contagious, more especially the bright virtue known as patriotism, or love of country. That the lofty example of this immaculate and unimpeachable witness for the crown to refer to whom, however unworthily, was an honour, had communicated itself to the prisoner's servant, and had engendered in him a holy determination to examine his master's table drawers and pockets, and secret his papers. That he, Mr. Attorney General, was prepared to hear some disparagement attempted of this admirable servant, but that, in a general way, he preferred him to his, Mr. Attorney General's, brothers and sisters, and honored him more than his, Mr. Attorney General's, father and mother. That he called with confidence on the jury to come and do likewise, that the evidence of these two witnesses, coupled with the documents of their discovering that would be produced, would show the prisoner to have been furnished with lists of His Majesty's forces, and of their disposition and preparation both by sea and land, that would leave no doubt that he had habitually conveyed such information to a hostile power, that these lists could not be proved to be in the prisoner's handwriting, but that it was all the same, that, indeed, it was rather the better for the prosecution, as showing the prisoner to be artful in his precautions, that the proof would go back 5 years, and would show the prisoner already engaged in these pernicious missions, within a few weeks before the date of the very first action fought between the British troops and the Americans, that, for these reasons, the jury being a loyal jury as he knew they were, and being a responsible jury as they knew they were, must positively find the prisoner guilty and make an end of him, whether they liked it or not, that they never could tolerate the idea of their wives laying their heads upon their pillows, that they never could endure the notion of their children laying their heads upon their pillows, in short, that there never could be for them or theirs any laying of heads upon pillows at all, unless the prisoner's head was taken off. That head, Mr. Attorney General concluded by demanding of them in the name of everything he could think of with a round turn on it, and on the faith of his solemn asseveration that he had already considered the prisoner as good as dead and gone. When the Attorney General ceased, a buzz arose in the court as if a crowd of great blue flies were swarming about the prisoner, in anticipation of what he was soon to become. When it toned down again, the unimpeachable patriot appeared in the witness-box. Mr. Solicitor General, then, following his leader's lead, examined the patriot, John Barsad, gentleman by name. The story of his pure soul was exactly what Mr. Attorney General had described it to be, perhaps, if it had a fault, a little too exactly. Having released his noble bosom of its burden, he would have modestly withdrawn himself, but that wigged gentleman with the papers before him, sitting not far from Mr. Lorry, begged to ask him a few questions. The wigged gentleman sitting opposite, still looking at the ceiling of the court. Had he ever been a spy himself? No, he scorned the base insinuation. What did he live upon? His property. Where was his property? He didn't precisely remember where it was. What was it? No business of anybody's. Had he inherited it? Yes, he had. From whom? Distant relation. Very distant? Rather. Ever been in prison? Certainly not. Never in a debtor's prison? Didn't see what that had to do with it. Never in a debtor's prison? Come, once again, never? Yes. How many times? 2 or 3 times. Not 5 or 6? Perhaps. Of what profession? Gentleman. Ever been kicked? Might have been. Frequently? No. Ever kicked downstairs? Decidedly not. once received a kick on the top of a staircase and then fell downwards of his own accord. Kicked on that occasion for cheating at dice? Something to that effect was said by the intoxicated liar who committed the assault, but it was not true. Swear that it was not true? Positively. Ever live by cheating at play? Never. Ever live by play? Not more than other gentlemen do. Ever borrow money of the prisoner? Yes. Ever pay him? No. Was not this intimacy with the prisoner in reality a very slight one, forced upon the prisoner in coaches, inns, and packets? No. Sure he saw the prisoner within the lists? Certain. Knew no more about the lists? No. Had not procured them himself, for instance? No. Expect to get anything by this evidence? No. Not in regular government pay and employment to lay traps? Oh, dear, no. Or to do anything? Oh, dear, no. Swear that? Over and over again. No motives but motives of sheer patriotism? None. Whatever. The virtuous servant, Roger Cly, swore his way through the case at a great rate. He had taken service with the prisoner, in good faith and simplicity, 4 years ago. He had asked the prisoner, aboard the Calais packet, if he wanted a handy fellow, and the prisoner had engaged him. He had not asked the prisoner to take the handy fellow as an act of charity, never thought of such a thing. He began to have suspicions of the prisoner, and to keep an eye upon him soon afterwards. In arranging his clothes while travelling, he had seen similar lists to these in the prisoner's pockets over and over again. He had taken these lists from the drawer of the prisoner's desk. He had not put them there first. He had seen the prisoner show these identical lists to French gentlemen at Calais, and similar lists to French gentlemen both at Calais and Bologna. He loved his country, and couldn't bear it, and had given information. He had never been suspected of stealing a silver teapot. He had been maligned respecting a mustard pot, but it turned out only to be a plated one. He had known the last witnesses 7 or 8 years, but that was merely a coincidence. He didn't call it a particularly curious coincidence. Most coincidences were curious. Neither did he call it a curious coincidence that true patriotism was his only motive, too. He was a true Briton, and hoped there were many like him. The blue flies buzzed again, and Mr. Attorney General called Mr. Jarvis Lorry. "Mr. Jarvis Lorry, are you a clerk in Tellson's Bank?" "I am." "On a certain Friday night in November 1775, did business occasion you to travel between London and Dover by the mail?" "It did." "Were there any other passengers in the mail?" "Two." "Did they alight on the road in the course of the night?" "They did." "Mr. Lorry, look upon the prisoner. Was he one of those two passengers?" "I cannot undertake to say that he was." "Does he resemble either of these two passengers?" "Both were so wrapped up, and the night was so dark, and we were all so reserved, that I cannot undertake to say even that." "Mr. Lorry, look upon the prisoner. Supposing him wrapped up, as those two passengers were, is there anything in his bulk and stature to render it unlikely that he was one of them?" "No." "You will not swear, Mr. Lorry, that he was not one of them?" "No." "So at least you say he may have been one of them?" "Yes, except that I remember them both to have been, like myself, timorous of highwaymen, and the prisoner has not a timorous air." "Did you ever see a counterfeit of timidity, Mr. Lorry?" I certainly have seen that. Mr. Lorry, look upon the prisoner once more. Have you seen him, to your certain knowledge, before?
I have.
When? I was returning from France a few days afterwards, and at Calais the prisoner came aboard the packet ship in which I returned and made the voyage with me.
At what hour did he come on board?
At a little after midnight.
In the dead of night? Was he the only passenger who came on board at that untimely hour?
He happened to be the only one.
Never mind about happening, Mr. Lorry. He was the only passenger who came on board in the dead of night?
He was.
Were you traveling alone, Mr. Lorry, or with any companion?
With two companions, a gentleman and a lady. They are here.
They are here.
Had you any conversation with the prisoner?
Hardly any. The weather was stormy, and the passage long and rough, and I lay on a sofa almost from shore to shore.
Miss Manette! The young lady, to whom all eyes had been turned before, and were now turned again, stood up where she had sat. Her father rose with her, and kept her hand drawn through his arm.
Miss Manette, look upon the prisoner.
To be confronted with such pity and such earnest youth and beauty was far more trying to the accused than to be confronted with all the crowd. Standing, as it were, apart with her on the edge of his grave, not all the staring curiosity that looked on could for the moment nerve him to remain quite still. His hurried right hand parcelled out the herbs before him into imaginary beds of flowers in a garden, and his efforts to control and steady his breathing shook the lips from which the colour rushed to his heart. The buzz of the great flies was loud again.
Miss Manette, have you seen the prisoner before?
Yes, sir.
Where?
On board the packet ship just now referred to, sir, and on the same occasion.
You are the young lady just now referred to?
Oh, most unhappily I am.
The plaintive tone of her compassion merged into the less musical voice of the judge, as he said something fiercely.
Answer the questions put to you, and make no remark upon them.
Miss Manette, had you any conversation with the prisoner on that passage across the channel?
Yes, sir.
Recall it.
In the midst of a profound stillness, she faintly began,
"When the gentleman came on board..."
"Do you mean the prisoner?" inquired the judge, knitting his brows.
"Yes, my lord."
"Then say the prisoner."
"When the prisoner came on board, he noticed that my father," turning her eyes lovingly to him as he stood beside her, "was much fatigued and in a very weak state of health. My father was so reduced that I was afraid to take him out of the air, and I had made a bed for him on the deck near the cabin steps, and I sat on the deck at his side to take care of him. There were no other passengers that night but we four. The prisoner was so good as to beg permission to advise me how I could shelter my father from the wind and the weather better than I had done. I had not known how to do it well, not understanding how the wind would set when we were out of the harbor. He did it for me. He expressed great kindness and kindness for my father's state, and I'm sure he felt it. That was the manner of our beginning to speak together."
"Let me interrupt you a moment. Had he come on board alone?"
"No."
"How many were with him?"
"Two French gentlemen."
"Had they conferred together?"
"They had conferred together until the last moment, when it was necessary for the French gentlemen to be landed in their boat."
"Had any papers been handed about among them, similar to these lists?"
"Some papers were handed among them, but I don't know what papers.
Like these, in shape and size?
Possibly, but indeed I don't know, although they stood whispering very near to me, because they stood at the top of the cabin steps to have the light of the lamp that was hanging there. It was a dull lamp, and they spoke very low, and I did not hear what they said, and saw only that they looked at papers.
Now on to the prisoner's conversation, Miss Manette.
The prisoner was as open as in his confidence with me, which arose out of my helpless situation, and he was kind and good and useful to my father. I hope, bursting into tears, I may not repay him by doing him harm today.
Buzzing from the blue flies. Miss Manette, if the prisoner does not perfectly understand that you give evidence which it is your duty to give, which you must give, and which you cannot escape from giving, with great unwillingness, he is the only person present in that condition. Please to go on.
He told me that he was traveling on business of a delicate and difficult nature, which might get people into trouble, and that he was therefore traveling under an assumed name. He said that his business had, within a few days, taken him to France, and might at intervals take him backwards and forwards between France and England for a long time to come.
Did he say anything about America, Miss Manette? Be particular.
He tried to explain to me how that quarrel had arisen, and he had said that, so far as he could judge, it was a wrong and foolish one on England's part. He added in a jesting way that perhaps George Washington might gain almost as great a name in history as George the Third. But there was no harm in his way of saying this. It was said laughingly, and to beguile the time.
Any strongly marked expression of face on the part of a chief actor in a scene of great interest, to whom all eyes are directed, will be unconsciously imitated by the spectators. Her forehead was painfully anxious and intent as she gave this evidence, and in the pauses when she stopped for the judge to write it down, watched its effect upon the counsel for and against. Among the lookers-on there was the same expression in all quarters of the court, insomuch that a great majority of the foreheads there might have been mirrors reflecting the witness, when the judge, looking up from his notes to glare at that tremendous heresy at George Washington. Mr. Attorney General now signified to my lord that he deemed it necessary, as a matter of precaution and form, to call the young lady's father, Dr. Manette, who was called accordingly.
Dr. Manette, look upon the prisoner. Have you seen him before?
Once, when he called at my lodgings in London, some 3 years or 3.5 years ago.
Can you identify him as your fellow passenger on board the packet, or speak to his conversation with your daughter?
Sir, I can do neither.
Is there any particular and special reason for your being unable to do either?
He answered in a low voice.
There is.
Has it been your misfortune to undergo a long imprisonment without trial or even accusation in your native country, Dr. Manette?
He answered in a tone that went to every heart.
A long imprisonment.
Were you newly released on the occasion in question?
They tell me so.
Have you no remembrance of the occasion?
None. My mind is a blank. From some time, I cannot even say what time, when I employed myself in my captivity in making shoes, to the time when I found myself living in London with my dear daughter here. She had become familiar to me when a gracious God restored my faculties, but I am quite unable even to say how she had become familiar. I have no remembrance of the process.
Mr. Attorney General sat down, and the father and daughter sat down together. A singular circumstance then arose in the case, the object in hand being to show that the prisoner went down with some fellow plotter untracked in the Dover Mail on that Friday night in November 5 years ago, and had got out of the mail in the night as a blind at some place where he did not remain, but from which he travelled back some dozen miles or more to a garrison and dockyard, and there collected information. A witness was called to identify him as having been at the precise time required in the coffee-room of an hotel in that garrison and dockyard town waiting for another person. The prisoner's counsel was cross-examining the witness with no result, except that he had never seen the prisoner on any other occasion when the wigged gentleman who had all this time been looking up at the ceiling of the court wrote a word or two on a little piece of paper, screwed it up, and tossed it to him. Opening this piece of paper in the next pause, the counsel looked with great attention and curiosity at the prisoner. "You say again you are quite sure it was the prisoner?" The witness was quite sure. "Did you ever see anybody very like the prisoner?" "Not so like," the witness said, "as that he could be mistaken." "Look well upon that gentleman, my learned friend there," pointing to him who had tossed the paper over, "and then look well upon the prisoner. How say you? Are they very like each other?" Allowing for my learned friend's appearance being careless and slovenly, if not debauched, they were sufficiently like each other to surprise not only the witness, but everybody present when they were thus brought into comparison. My lord, being prayed to bid my learned friend lay aside his wig, and giving no very gracious consent, the likeness became more remarkable. My lord inquired of Mr. Stryver, the prisoner's counsel, whether they were next to try Mr. Carton, the name of my learned friend, for treason. Mr. Stryver replied to my lord no, but that he would ask the witness to tell him whether what had happened once might happen twice, whether he could have been so confident if he had seen this illustration of his rashness sooner, whether he would be so competent having seen it and more, the upshot of which was to smash this witness like a crockery vessel and shiver his part of the case to useless lumber. Mr. Cruncher had by this time taken quite a lunch of rust off his fingers in the following of the evidence. He had now to attend while Mr. Stryver fitted the prisoner's case on the jury, like a compact suit of clothes, showing them how the patriot Barsad was a hired spy and traitor, an unblushing trafficker in blood, and one of the greatest scoundrels upon the earth since accursed Judas, which he certainly did look rather like, how the virtuous servant Cly was his friend and partner and was worthy to be, how watchful eyes of these forgers and false swearers had rested upon the prisoner as a victim, because some family affairs in France, he being of French extraction, did require his making those passages across the Channel, though what those affairs were, a consideration for others who were near and dear to him forbade him, even for his life, to disclose, how the evidence that had been warped and wrested from the young lady, whose anguish in giving it they had witnessed come to nothing, involving the mere little innocent gallantries and politenesses likely to pass between any young gentleman and young lady so thrown together, with the exception of that reference to George Washington, which was altogether too extravagant and impossible to regard in any light other than as a monstrous joke,
how it would be a weakness in the government to break down in this attempt to practice for popularity on the lowest national antipathies and fears, and therefore Mr. Attorney General had made the most of it, how nevertheless it rested upon nothing save that vile and infamous character of evidence too often disfiguring such cases, and of which state trials in this country were full. But there my lord interposed, with as grave a face as if it had not been true, saying that he could not sit upon that bench and suffer those allusions. Mr. Stryver then called his few witnesses, and Mr. Cruncher had next to attend, while Mr. Attorney General turned the whole suit of clothes Mr. Stryver had fitted on the jury inside out, showing how Barsad and Clive were even 100 times better than he had thought them, and that the prisoner 100 times worse. Lastly came my lord himself, turning the suit of clothes now inside out, now outside in, but on the whole decidedly trimming and shaping them into grave clothes for the prisoner. And now the jury turned to consider, and the great flies swarmed again. Mr. Carton, who had so long sat looking at the ceiling of the court, changed neither his place nor his attitude, even in this excitement, while his teamed friend, Mr. Stryver, messing his papers before him, whispered with those who sat near, and from time to time glanced anxiously at the jury, while all the spectators moved, more or less, and grouped themselves anew, while even my lord himself rose from his seat and slowly paced up and down his platform, not unattended by a suspicion in the minds of the audience that his state was feverish. This one man sat leaning back with his torn gown half off him, his untidy wig put on just as it happened to fight on his head after its removal, his hands in his pockets, and his eyes on the ceiling as they had been all day. Something especially reckless in his demeanor not only gave him a disreputable look, but so diminished the strong resemblance he undoubtedly bore to the prisoner, which his momentary earnestness, when they were compared together, had strengthened, that many of the lookers-on, taking note of him now, said to one another that they would hardly have thought the two were so alike. Mr. Cruncher made the observation to his next neighbor, and added, "I'd hold half a guinea that he doesn't have no law work to do. Doesn't look like the sort of one to get any, do he?" Yet this Mr. Carton took in more of the details of the scene than he appeared to take in, for now, when Miss Manette's head dropped upon her father's breast, he was the first to see it, and to say audibly, "Officer, look to that young lady. Help the gentleman to take her out. Don't you see she will fall?" There was much commiseration for her as she was removed, and much sympathy with her father. It had evidently been a great distress to him to have the days of his imprisonment recalled. He had shown strong internal agitation when he was questioned, and that pondering or brooding look which made him old had been upon him like a heavy cloud ever since. As he passed out, the jury, who had turned back and paused a moment, spoke through their foreman. They were not agreed, and wished to retire. My lord, perhaps with George Washington on his mind, showed some surprise that they were not agreed, but signified his pleasure that they should retire under watch and ward, and retired himself. The trial had lasted all day, and the lamps in the court were now being lighted. It began to be rumored that the jury would be out a long while. The spectators dropped off to get refreshment, and the prisoner withdrew to the back of the dock and sat down. Mr. Lorry, who had gone out when the young lady and her father went out, now reappeared and beckoned to Jerry, who, in the slackened interest, could easily get near him. "Jerry, if you wish to take something to eat, you can, but keep in the way. You will be sure to hear when the jury come in.
don't be a moment behind them, for I want you to take the verdict back to the bank. You are the quickest messenger I know, and will get to Temple Bar long before I can." Jerry had just enough forehead to knuckle, and he knuckled it in acknowledgment of this communication and a shilling. Mr. Carton came up at that moment and touched Mr. Lorry on the arm. "How is the young lady?" "She is greatly distressed, but her father is comforting her, and she feels better for being out of court." "I'll tell the prisoner so. It wouldn't do for a respectable bank gentleman like you to be seen speaking to him publicly, you know." Mr. Lorry reddened as if he were conscious of having debated the point in his mind, and Mr. Carton made his way outside of the bar. The way out of court lay in that direction, and Jerry followed him, all eyes, ears, and spikes. "Mr. Darnay," the prisoner came forward directly. "You will naturally be anxious to hear of the witness, Miss Manette. She will do very well. You have seen the worst of her agitation." "I am deeply sorry to have been the cause of it. Could you tell her so for me with my fervent acknowledgments?" "Yes, I could. I will, if you ask it." Mr. Carton's manner was so careless as to be almost insolent. He stood half-turned from the prisoner, lounging with his elbow against the bar. "I do ask it. Accept my cordial thanks." "What?" said Carton, still only half-turned toward him. "Do you expect, Mr. Darnay?" "The worst." "That is the wisest thing to expect, and the likeliest. But I think their withdrawing is in your favor." Loitering on the way out of court not being allowed, Jerry heard no more, but left them, so like each other in feature, so unlike each other in manner, standing side by side, both reflected in the glass above them. An hour and a half limped heavily away in the thief and rascal crowded passages below, even though assisted off with mutton pies and ale. The hoarse messenger, uncomfortably seated on a form after taking that refection, had dropped into a doze, with a loud murmur and a rapid tide of people setting up the stairs that led to the court, carried him along with them. "Jerry! Jerry!" Mr. Lorry was already calling at the door when he got there. "Here, sir. It's a fight to get back again. Here I am, sir." Mr. Lorry handed him a paper through the throng. "Quick, have you got it?" "Yes, sir." Hastily written on the paper was the word, "Acquitted." "If you had sent the message recalled to life again," muttered Jerry as he turned, "I should have known what you meant this time." He had no opportunity of saying, or so much as thinking, anything else until he was clear of the Old Bailey, for the crowd came pouring out with a vehemence that nearly took him off his legs, and a loud buzz swept into the street, as if the baffled blue flies were dispersing in search of other carrion. Thus ends Book 2, Chapter 3, A Disappointment.